to apply international standards to the Palestinians, simply not to apply different standards. This is what I'm asking for. The real number of refugees would be less than 10,000 people.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons. We're recording a special episode of our podcast about what is happening in the Middle East behind the headlines and the spin. For those who listen to the recorded version of this, we will have an interview in the end with Adi Schwartz, the co-author of the War of Return, expert on the Palestinians striving to have the right of return to Israel. But now we're going to open with a discussion of the big news on Monday, September 29th, which is the press conference between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump, and Trump's 20-point plan, not 21-point plan, to end the war on Gaza. So I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider. And I'm here with my co-host.
This is Asher Fredman, co-host of Mideast Horizons and executive director of the Misgav Institute for National Security, Israel's leading national security policy center. And this evening was very dramatic and is going to have far-ranging implications for the region. Lahav, what did you make of the press conference that we just saw? And after all the many words, what are the most important questions?
That's two different questions. So I'll start with what I made of it, which is that it's mixed. I think in broad strokes, it does meet sort of Israel's war aims. I mean, if Hamas accepts the deal, which is another area that we should discuss, right? It's releasing all the hostages, the disarming Hamas and removing Hamas power from the Gaza Strip, from Palestinians. But the devil is in the details, as it is with a lot of things. So, you know, we'll have to get, there are a lot of questions and there are contradictions between the document that the Trump administration released and some of the things that they said in the press conference. But Asher, what's your broad take on this before we get into that?
So I would say that there are, first of all, I think what's really happened here is that Israel has agreed that in return for the release of all the hostages, all 48 hostages, maybe in the end of the day, it'll be the 20 living hostages, but officially the 48 hostages, it will end the war and agree to arrangements which, in my view, are very unlikely to bring lasting peace to the Middle East, probably will kick the can down the road to the next round of fighting in Gaza in a year, 2 years, 3 years, and we can discuss why that is. Israel decided that's worth it. We are going to essentially allow Hamas to survive in Gaza in return for getting all our hostages back. And now there are, I think, two critical questions. One is, Hamas isn't going to say yes, it's not going to say no. It'll say one of two things. It'll say either, we're willing to give all the hostages back, but we don't know where all of them are. So therefore, Israel needs to withdraw fully and stop all operations. And then we can start looking for them. And maybe Islam Jihad holds some of them. And maybe some of them are buried. We'll do our best to find all of them. We'll give you some of them. Or Hamas will come out and straight and say, look, we are willing to give all the hostages back, but not in 72 hours. Only in stages, gradually, after we hit benchmarks. And then Israel is going to face, okay, do we say then forget it, we're rejecting the deal, we're going back to high-intensity fighting? Will the Americans say, okay, go ahead and resume a full-intensity war? What will the Israeli public say? That's the first critical question. And the second critical question is, and you yourself, Lahav, noted in contradiction between, apparently between what the president actually apparently said, and I believe it's clause number 17 in the 21-point plan or the 20-point plan.
I think there's a few contradictions between what was said in the press conference and what's written in the plan. I have them all laid out. So when it's my turn, I'll lay them all out.
So I'll just point out this one, which is, according to what the 20-point plan or the plan, if Hamas rejects the deal, the deal is still implemented in areas currently controlled by Israel. Now, the president said, if I understood correctly, was that if Hamas rejects the deal, he gives full American backing to let Bibi do what he needs to do, essentially to defeat Hamas militarily. Now, in my view, if there is American pressure to implement the deal in certain areas of Gaza, even after Hamas rejects the deal and doesn't release the hostages, that is very dangerous. Because if Israel can't operate in specific areas, it'll have trouble operating throughout Gaza. And if there are Egyptian or Indonesian or other soldiers in those areas, Israel runs the grave risk of injuring inadvertently those soldiers. And additionally, if there are areas where Israel can't operate because these are areas now under Egyptian jurisdiction or some other country's jurisdiction, then Hamas will simply operate from tunnels within those areas. So for this deal to be work, it must be clear that if Hamas rejects it, it is not implemented anywhere in the Gaza Strip.
Well, I think part of the deal, right, is this eventual deployment of the International Stabilization Force, which doesn't exist yet, right? We don't know which countries are going to be in it. We have some educated guesses, right? So I think it won't happen for a long time. It could be of several weeks at least, you know, but probably a few months. That's also part of, like, they're presenting as if, like, this is the plan. This is going to happen right now. The only thing that's supposed to happen right now is the end of the war and the release of the hostages, which, of course, requires Hamas's agreement. But yeah, I mean, I have the quotes here. So there's definitely a contradiction between what the text says if Hamas rejects it and what they said in the press conference, right? So the text says, in the event Hamas delays or rejects this proposal, the above, which are, you know, the broad strokes of the deal, including the scaled-up aid operation, will proceed in the terror-free areas handed over from the IDF to the ISF, right? The ISF being the International Stabilization Force. So again, it's a force that doesn't exist. We don't know when it's going to exist. We don't know who's going to be in it. And so if Hamas doesn't agree to this deal, I mean, it basically means the war could continue for months, really, right? Like, nowhere does Israel agree to not shoot a gun or a tank ever again if Hamas doesn't agree to the deal. And then Trump says to Netanyahu, if Hamas rejects the deal, they're the only one left. If they do it, which he means reject it, you know, Bibi, you have the full backing to do what you have to do. And then Netanyahu says later in his part of the press conference that if Hamas rejects the plan, quote, Israel will finish the job by itself. This can be done the easy way or it can be done the hard way, but it will be done. We didn't fight this horrible fight, sacrifice the finest of our young men to have Hamas stay in Gaza. So this to me connects to a different contradiction. Let me just open those quotes where Netanyahu says Gaza will have a peaceful administration that is run neither by Hamas nor by the Palestinian Authority. And the plan actually says that eventually the Palestinian Authority will run Gaza. But yesterday, in an interview with Fox News, Netanyahu said on that topic, if all of that is turned on its head, there's a tremendous transformation. Good luck. Some people believe it happens. I don't think it's going to happen. So I think Netanyahu is agreeing to things that he doesn't actually want to happen, and he's sort of relying on, you know, what Abba Evans said, that they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. That's really what it looks like. Now, it's worked in the past, but it does seem like a big risk.
Personally, and this is just my personal view, if the deal would indeed lead to the release of all our hostages within 72 hours, I think that Israel should take it. I think I've long argued that Hamas is not going to release all the hostages, and I would love nothing more than to be proved wrong and have to eat my hat, and I would do so very happily. And I think that case, and if it means a war in 2 or 3 years, you know, when we hear about this International Stabilization Force, yes, it's different that it's under American leadership rather than under UN leadership, but it still is reminiscent of bodies like UNIFIL that have French troops and Italian troops and Spanish troops and Indonesian troops, and in the end did nothing more than provide cover for Hamas, but again, for Hezbollah. But again, if it leads to the release of all the hostages, I think Israel should take it. The question is, again, of course, what happens if Hamas... Now, we have to recall, Israel had full American backing for its operations in Gaza even before, right? President Trump said, shortly after he returned to office, he said, Israel should open the gates of hell in Gaza. It was Israel, because of the hostages, because of domestic considerations, that chose to operate because of opposition within the IDF, within the defense establishment, that chose to operate in a much more gradual manner. Even if Hamas rejects the deal, it's hard for me to imagine Israel actually going all out in all parts of the Gaza Strip. It'll still proceed carefully, gradually, deliberately, because of the fear of harming the hostages. So I don't think it'll lead to a very dramatic change. I also think that President Trump, he had this great line. He said, he was talking about his UN speech. He said, if it doesn't come from the heart, it's not good, or it has to come from the heart. He was talking about his UN speech because the teleprompter didn't work. But I think that's also a good summary of how he speaks. And for example, he said correctly, he said the he ended funding for UNRWA, for the UN Refugee Works Agency, that very corrupt organization. But the agreement has a huge amount of aid going via the UN, i.e. UNRWA, to Gaza. So there are, you know, between a recognition of the reality and what's written in the deal, there are numerous gaps.
You know, I would add specifically on that topic of aid that I don't think that they did say that the UN and the Red Cross would be involved in delivering aid, but I don't think they ruled out the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation continuing to deliver aid. They said that there would be no group or whatever, I don't remember the exact word, that would be affiliated with either side, either the Israelis or the Palestinians. And even though the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was an idea of an Israeli, our podcast guest, Michael Eisenberg, was one of the
allegedly,
people who accepted
allegedly.
This idea. Allegedly, according to the New York Times, he won't talk about it. But it's Michael Eisenberg and also Liran Tantzman, who's a tech guy. I'm like he deserves a better title than that, but it's late. I'm tired. In any case, it is technically a fully American project, right? Like an Israeli had the idea, but the Americans ran with it and it has no concrete connection with Israel as far as we know. Some have accused Israel of funding it, but they deny that. So I think it does leave an opening for the GHF to continue, but will there be that much of a point if the UN and the Red Cross are there? I don't know. I mean, I guess the UN has been pretty inept in distributing the aid up until now.
So, Love, you are a leading expert and commentator on the Israeli political situation as well. What happens now in terms of the Israeli political situation, the government? What do you think we're going to see tomorrow, essentially, or later tonight?
The Israeli right is really angry. You know what? Let me pull up this other comment I saw that was really telling. Netanyahu's former spokesman, Omer Dostri, who we both know pretty well, he wrote a really, really angry tweet. Now, he just stopped being Netanyahu's spokesman, I think, 2 or 3 months ago. And he said that the plan is a glorious failure. He said it leaves Hamas in Gaza instead of decisively removing Hamas from Gaza. I think it's because, to interpret that, like if you look at the points of the deal, so they say that members of Hamas could be exiled, or if they agree to like give up on the way of terror and support peace, then there'll be amnesty for them. So to some people, that might be leaving Hamas in Gaza. Abandoning territory by the IDF to narrow borders. So the map, which we didn't discuss, ultimately has the IDF just retaining a perimeter around Gaza, which I will say is all that this government has actually promised, right? Netanyahu, Dermer, Defense Minister Katz, like the people who actually make those decisions never promised that there would be more than the perimeter, even though there are cabinet ministers who want a lot more than that. Managing Gaza, including enforcement by a naive foreign administration. So that's what we were talking about, right? Like, can we really trust the world to administer Gaza? Preparing the ground for the return of the Palestinian Authority and the establishment of a Palestinian state. I mean, it says it explicitly in the plan, right? That the Palestinian Authority has to undergo certain reforms. Once they undergo the reforms, they can administer Gaza, and that's viewed as a pathway to a Palestinian state, right? And then last but not least, canceling the voluntary migration plan, meaning they're no longer encouraging Gazans to leave. It actually says specifically that they're going to encourage Gazans to stay in Gaza. I think, look, like Dostri is not a Knesset member, no one voted for him, whatever, but I think that he very succinctly summed up the view of a lot of the Israeli right, or certainly to the right of Likud, on this matter. Within Likud, there are sort of more moderate voices who are very supportive of this. I think we're in an election year anyway. That's the thing. Like that, at least this Jewish year, you know, maybe not 2025, but Tafshin Peivav. And so, like, if this creates a dynamic by which the coalition falls apart, the election wouldn't be that much earlier than it's supposed to be. So I think in a way, Netanyahu is willing to take this risk.
I think you're right. In any case, elections would likely be in March, June, or October of 2026. So Netanyahu is clearly thinking about what happens in elections. I don't think this is going to serve him well among the right in elections. I assume that the United States and Qatar will pressure Hamas not to carry out big parades, at least for a number of months.
We should talk about Qatar. Just
right, right, for sure.
Yeah, anyway, keep going.
But I think so there'll probably be some pressure on Hamas not to carry out, you know, big parades like we saw in the past, at least for a number of months. And Netanyahu will be hoping that the elections will take place without visible signs of Hamas's continued or overly overt signs of Hamas's continued pressure. Maybe, for example, that Hamas, when it steals the aid, will claim that it's local gangs, like local gangs that it controls, that are doing it and not Hamas. We should also be clear that the idea of Hamas not being playing a role in the government is not an achievement. Hamas has been clear for months that it is happy to allow technocrats or other Palestinians to run the day-to-day administration of Gaza, as long, of course, as it remains the main power on the ground. Now, if this regarding the Palestinian Authority and the path to the state, because I think you're right, that could be one of the main linchpins that determines how quickly we go to elections. This brings us back to the argument over the Peace to Prosperity Plan, the Deal of the Century, where some people argued it obviously was in many ways good for Israel's security, and the Palestinians will never live up to the demands made of them in the plan. And others said, no, even if we don't believe the Palestinians are going.
An important note, the demands of the Peace to Prosperity Plan from the Palestinians are the same demands that are being made of them now in order to enter Gaza. It says in the 20-point plan that the Palestinian reforms have to follow the 2020 Peace to Prosperity Plan, which you guys can look. I tweeted a screenshot of what those demands are on my feed. I'm not going to read them all out to you now, but they're pretty extensive.
But it should be pointed out that while President Trump did not list them, just said the plans in my vision, Netanyahu was the one who actually listed them. And again, then that'll go into the details too, right? The Palestinians have already claimed to that instead of paying the terrorists directly, they paying it via an NGO that's headed by a PA minister. So that's a reform. They can make changes to textbooks, but are they going to actually rename the dozens of schools that are named after terrorists like Dalal Mughrabi and other terrorists whose claim to fame is that they murdered many Jews in cold blood? Are they going to rename the summer camps? Are they going to give up on the goal of having the descendants of refugees return to their former homes? I think that is unlikely. And then the question is, what will be the...
They're supposed to basically become a democracy, a constitutional democracy. And we know the last time they held real elections in the Palestinian Authority, Hamas won the parliament of Gaza and overthrew the Palestinian Authority. So there's a huge risk inherent there as well. I mean, I have the naive George W. Bush era belief that people deserve to elect their leaders, that they have to live with the bad choices they make. But Israel is also going to have to live with the bad choice.
It's true. And in some ways, when I was reading the plan, it's true. Doesn't talk in regards to Gaza, it talks about economic development much more than it talks about democracy. But it did sound a little bit like how some people approached Iraq, right? The idea that we are going to rebuild the country into Singapore or Dubai or whatever it is. And President Trump obviously is counting on the experience and the capacities of countries in the Gulf and others to make that happen, which I guess is different than the American experience in Baghdad. But you're going to run also into the social realities and the economic realities in Gaza, which is going to, and assuming that 2 million or most of the 2 million of Gazans remain in Gaza, that it's going to be very, very hard to actually, it's not Dubai. It's not Dubai in so many different ways that it's going to be very hard to actually create anything looking like the reality that's described in the plan.
It reminds me of when the disengagement happened and there were people who said that Gaza could become the Singapore of the Middle East. I'm trying to remember if that was like Shimon Peres. Sounds like something Shimon Peres would say, but I don't remember exactly who said it. We have a few minutes left. We said we're going to stay till 11 p.m. Israel time. Let's talk about Qatar. When this was initially leaked to the press as a 21-point plan, one of the points was apologizing to Qatar and committing to not attacking on Qatari ground again. And Netanyahu did those things before the press conference in a call with the prime minister, with Prime Minister Al-Thani. Trump, Netanyahu, and Al-Thani. And then in the press conference, Netanyahu said he's deeply grateful for all their work. and that Israel was targeting terrorists, not the citizens of Qatar. They expressed regret that Israel killed a Qatari security guard. He said he was targeting terrorists and not Qataris.
Who's the security guard guarding, by the way?
Yeah, guarding terrorists, exactly. Well, that's the problem with Qatar, right? The whole time we're supposed to be extremely grateful for them for mediating. But if they hadn't been funneling so much money into Gaza, probably Hamas wouldn't have been able to do October 7th. Now, Israel has a role in this too, in the sense that Israel was, you know, not doing enough to make sure the money was going to the right places, to like civil welfare type things, as it was supposed to. But the Qataris, I mean, they sent the money to Hamas. They harbor Hamas terrorists in Doha. They fund Al Jazeera. And like Netanyahu says that there's going to be a Israel US Qatar body to work out their quote unquote respected grievances, and then he like
scoffed, just like the Israeli PA, American body that was supposed to deal with incitement as part of Oslo.
Yeah, I mean, like, oh, this body gonna completely change the nature of Al Jazeera? It just sounds like absurd. And I get like, in diplomacy, sometimes you have to do things that are absurd, and like maybe for now it's worth it if like we end the war in a good way. Maybe. But I feel like the problem of Qatar for Israel, and frankly for Jews, because they promote anti-Semitism through Al Jazeera, it's like people keep kicking the can down the road and it needs to be dealt with. And the Trump administration, not only them, but you know, the Biden administration felt like this too. For the most part, like, they act like there's no problem at all.
I think you're right. I think that Qatar is one of the winners of this deal. Meir Ben Shabbat, the chair of the Miskav Institute, and myself published way back, I think, in 2023, soon after October 7th, a piece in The Hill saying that if Qatar doesn't immediately deliver a release of the hostages, they should lose their designation as a special non-NATO ally of the United States and be designated as a state sponsor of terror. Al Jazeera is one of the forces that not only is promoting Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas extremism, but is also actively undermining the Abraham Accords, which President Trump sees as one of his crowning achievements. But to be honest, those who I would say the pro-Israel community or those who recognize Qatar have not been successful over the last 2 years in changing the opinion either of the administration or of many other thought leaders, including in the pro-Israel, say, political sphere. And I think Qatar comes out ahead, which is always, you know, it's the people, it's the Hamas members in Gaza that are actually the ones who are going to decide whether to release the hostages. The Hamas leaders in Gaza are talking to the Egyptians. They have a direct line to the Egyptians because they have a border with Egypt. The Doha is talking to the Hamas leaders in abroad who are important, but they're not the ones who make the ultimate decision. It seems to me that it was a tremendous mistake from the beginning not to have Egypt be the primary mediator with Hamas. It's a mistake that Israel made, and I think that Qatar does come out as one of the victors. Whether Netanyahu, I can understand why Netanyahu made the phone call if it was for a greater cause, for getting the deal done. If he gets the 48 hostages back, okay, it was worth it. But Qatar cements, or once again demonstrates, its very, very high stature, even though it is promoting anti-Semitism and supporting Hamas and spreading Muslim Brotherhood propaganda and undermining the Abraham Accords. And that's just an absurdity that we need to face. This week, we are joined by Dr. Adi Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is one of the foremost experts on the Israeli-Palestinian arena and on the Palestinian refugee issue. Dr. Schwartz is a senior fellow at the Miskav Institute for National Security and the author, together with Dr. Einat Wilf, of the groundbreaking work, War of Return, How Western Indulgence of the Palestinian Dream Has Obstructed the Path to Peace. Dr. Adi Schwartz, it's a great pleasure to have you on the Mideast Horizons podcast. We're speaking on Monday, September 29th, only a few hours before the expected meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. Press conference afterwards, much speculation about what they may announce about President Trump's 21-point plan. And you've argued that a key element in any plan, any future planning for Gaza, must be the extraction, the elimination of UNRWA and the cancellation of the refugee status for Gazans who are living under a Gazan transitional authority or whatever kind of local government is set up. Could you explain why that's so important and why the definition that UNRWA uses for refugees is so central to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to the future of Gaza?
Okay, so I think that my biggest concern is that we're going back to October 6th, and if we don't take certain measures, then we'll end up simply with having another round of fighting. Of course, this would be 2 years since October 7th, definitely a longer and more powerful round of fighting, but simply just another round of fighting. Instead of making it, you know, into a milestone, into a turning point in the history of the conflict. And that would mean that the Palestinians, after 100 years of the waging war against Zionism and against the Jewish people's project of creating a sovereign state, they should be told enough. They should be told that they have been trying for 100 years, for over a century, to practically destroy the Jewish state in any borders whatsoever, but that we have seen the destruction, we have seen October 7th, and we have seen what's happening afterwards. And that is the moment to say, okay, enough is enough. You are going to live next to a Jewish state and not trying to live instead of that Jewish state. Now, how does the refugee issue comes into this? Since 1948, the Palestinians were actually the only population on earth that were given the message that they are still refugees, again, from a war that ended in the 40s. There is no parallel for that situation. And we're now talking about the fourth and even fifth generation of Palestinian refugees. From 700,000 Palestinian refugees that were recorded or registered in 1948, we are currently having, according to UNRWA, the United Nations agency, more than 6 million Palestinian refugees. And by the way, if you ask the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and the PLO, they would talk about 8 to 9 million Palestinian refugees, because they consider also those who live in Germany or in Canada with Canadian passports to be Palestinian refugees. Now, this is not a coincidence. The Palestinian refugee problem was maintained as a political tool. This is not a humanitarian issue of refugees, hopeless people whom we have to help or shelter, or something that we think, you know, people who are really suffering, as we have seen in the civil war in Syria or in the case of the Ukraine. I'm talking now before October 7th. We had millions of Palestinians who were considered by UNRWA, again, refugees, but they had, for example, Jordanian citizenship. Again, this is the only case on earth when you can be a citizen of a functioning country, meaning Jordan, voting in the parliament, being elected. There were Palestinians who were even prime ministers in the state of Jordan, being able to leave the country and come back with a Jordanian passport, and still being considered by the international community as a refugee. Now, I just have a simple question. Why? Why is it? Is it just a coincidence? Is it just, you know, they just forgot to tell them that they're not refugees? No. The answer is that the Palestinians, and with them Arab countries, and here's the big problem, the international community went hand in hand with this charade, with this, you know, incredible inflation of the number of refugees, only as a weapon, as a political tool above the head of Israel. And this is the reason why this is exactly the right point to start the process in which the Palestinians should come to terms with the existence of the state of Israel. As long as they believe that 8 million, 9 million people have actually a legal right to return into the state of Israel. And this is the meaning of UNRWA. This is the meaning of UNRWA. This is the meaning of their cards, the refugee cards, meaning that they intend to turn Israel into an Arab state simply because of demographics. The number of Jews today in Israel, if you add to that millions of Arabs, Muslim, Palestinian, then this is no longer the Jewish state. So this is where we have to start, and this is why I'm advocating for changing the policy vis-a-vis the Palestinian refugees.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Go ahead.
If you cancel the refugee status, they're still stateless people, right? Like the Palestinians who live in Gaza, they don't have the Jordanian citizenship of most Palestinians was canceled. What do they do, right? You're not supposed, there's conventions on stateless people. And I think that in that sense, they do get a refugee status. It doesn't necessarily mean refugees have the right to return to Israel, right? But doesn't that make them refugees?
So Lahav, excuse me for telling you, but you are asking a very Western question, and someone who thinks that there is a problem and we have to solve the problem. That's typical to Americans, to Europeans, to Westerners. But what I'm trying to say, and that's a good question, we can answer that. But what I'm trying to make clear is that this is not some kind of a real tangible problem that we have to solve. The problem is ideological. The problem is sending the message that Israel is here to stay. And let me give you a few examples, because I was following the reactions on the Palestinian side whenever there was an attempt to touch UNRWA. So, for example, when Donald Trump, the administration, American administration, stopped the funding of UNRWA back in 2019, that was the first time. And the second time was in January or February 2024, when it was discovered that UNRWA employees were actually involved in October 7th. So there was a bunch of European countries, like a dozen of more. Most European countries said, oh, that's outrageous. They stopped the funding. And then I went into Palestinian newspapers or, you know, intellectuals. What are they saying? Are they saying exactly what you said? Oh my God, we have this bunch of people. Who will take care of them? Oh my God, we have clinics of UNRWA. And what will happen? We want to go to a doctor, you know, or our kids, they have to go to schools. None of that. The only thing they said, they are taking away our right of return. So for the Palestinians, UNRWA, refugee card, means one thing. Right of return, the destruction of Israel. Now, to your question, of that 6 or 8 or 9 million people, the problem is much less significant because, as I said, most or at least many of these people have citizenship. And people who are stateless, there are all kinds of... I'm not saying that this will solve immediately the entire Middle Eastern conflict, but I'm saying that unless we start to change the motivation... You know, people talk about the two-state solution, the one-state solution, the three-state solution... There's a word there saying solution. You can solve a problem if both sides try to solve it. But currently, we are in a position where one side, the Palestinians, envision only one solution. The only one solution is that the state of Israel as a Jewish state will cease to exist. Okay? Now, the majority of the Jews in Israel reject this proposition and they are willing to fight for it. So what I'm saying is that we have to create a change. It will be slow. It will take probably decades, perhaps. I don't know. But we have to start it some way. I think that the moment there will be a change of heart, the options, the political options, and this is what you were trying to ask, you know, how exactly are you going to solve the problem? When there's a will, there's a way. We're still not in a position where there's a will. Currently, the will, as we have all seen in the last 2 years, is to destroy the Jewish state. And this is the point I'm trying to make, because I think actually this is the huge elephant that for some reason I don't see enough people discussing and, you know, pointing and trying to touch upon.
Adi, as a senior fellow at the Miskav Institute, you published a paper on ending the Palestinian refugee distortion. And you called on the United States and on other countries to take a clear position as to the definition of a refugee in the context of the Palestinians and to say, given that definition, how many refugees do we actually believe that there are? So if you could explain for our listeners, first of all, what the definition, the difference is between the definition used by UNRWA and that used in all other refugee contexts. And if we were to apply the internationally accepted definition to the Palestinian case, approximately how many refugees, you've talked about 8 million, 9 million, 6 million, how many Palestinian refugees are there actually?
Okay, so what I'm calling for is actually sounds, you know, very simple and logic. to imply international standards to the Palestinians, simply not to apply different standards. Okay, this is what I'm asking for. And I can explain, but the real number of refugees would be less than 10,000 people. Okay, now let's take these 6 million people that the Palestinians, or actually UNRWA, is talking about and break it down. So more than 2 million of those 6 million live in Jordan. Almost all of them since 1950 were naturalized by the Kingdom of Jordan. So they're practically citizens of the Kingdom of Jordan. Now, in international, or at least according to international standards, while a refugee receives a new citizenship of a functioning country, he is no longer considered a refugee. So if we would apply international standards, immediately more than 2 million Palestinian refugees residing in Jordan, they would be automatically deleted off the list. Okay, so that's about 40%. Another 40% reside in the Gaza Strip and in Judea and Samaria. Now, I'm not talking about displacement that happened after October 7th, okay? I'm talking about from 1948 until our days. And by the way, when someone moves within a territory, so for example, movement from Gaza City to Rafah, okay? That is not considered refugeehood according to international standards. That could be an internally displaced person. That's the same thing as someone who, for example, lived in Kiryat Shmona and due to the war had to move to Haifa or to Tel Aviv. That's not considered refugee. Okay? Now, if you look at the conditions of these people, they never met the conditions of refugeehood, which is to cross an internationally recognized border. Okay? Now, what happened in 1948 or 1949 is that people, for example, from Jaffa or from Ashkelon or from Ashdod moved to the Gaza Strip. Okay? They moved south 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers, or from Beit She'an to Jenin. Okay? They moved 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers, but they have never crossed an internationally recognized border. That's the definition. If you did not cross an international border, you are not a refugee. Now, the Green Line, the Armistice Line of 1949, were never recognized, never meant to be internationally recognized border. So all of these people, 40%, that's additional to the 40% already in the Kingdom of Jordan, as Lav said before, they could be internally displaced people, they could be stateless people, but they are not refugees. Okay, according to any international standard, they would not have been recognized as refugees. That leaves us with 20%, half of them in Lebanon, half of them in Syria. So about half a million in both countries. Now, these are the numbers on the records of UNRWA. UNRWA had on its records about 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. But it happened that about a decade ago, the government of Lebanon ordered a census. They did a census, you know, nothing to do with Israel, nothing to do with the conflict with Israel. They just did a census. And, you know, huge surprise, instead of 500,000 Palestinians, they have only 170,000. So the number is inflated three times. Okay, so actually there's only one third of the registered Palestinian refugees. Do you ask yourself, how come? Well, I'll tell you, UNRWA is not deleting anyone from its records. So if you were born in Lebanon and automatically on the list, you know, every Palestinian newborn is automatically registered as refugee, but you left the country. Okay, you went to Turkey, you went to Germany, you went to the Gulf, you studied something, you stayed there, you're a successful businessman. Nobody in UNRWA is doing any kind of effort to see whether you're still there. So in fact, the number is 170,000. And given the situation in Syria in the last decade, it would be very much reasonable to believe that the number is probably even less. So the number of refugees, okay, who actually crossed an international border, because if you moved to Lebanon and in Syria, you did cross, okay, that's different than in the Gaza Strip and in Judea and Samaria, the number would be between 200,000 and 300,000. These are the people who are in Syria and Lebanon. But notice that we started with 6 million and we're now on 300,000. That means that 95% of the problem is artificial. Okay, that's what I'm trying to say. But
there's also the issue of the descendants, right? There's
exactly
a difference between how UNRWA and others look at the descendants of refugees.
Exactly, exactly. So if you look into those 200 or 300,000 and you actually break it down, there is, if you look at the, you know, age distribution in the Arab world, you will find that about 10,000 of them or less, 7,000 are actually 77 years old and more, meaning that they were actually alive and they were actually displaced from, you know, what became the state of Israel. All the rest are the descendants. Now, let me explain about the descendants. There's a huge difference between how UNRWA and the international other agency, meaning the entire world, is dealing with the descendants. In the case of UNRWA, it is simply automatic. So if a father is considered a refugee, by the way, himself probably being the grandson or the great-grandson of someone, then he simply comes to UNRWA and says, okay, I have a new baby, that's it, his name is XY, and he's a refugee automatically. No checks, no nothing. This is not the case with UNHCR. UNHCR is not automatic.
To explain to our listeners, what is UNHCR, for those who don't know?
Oh, UNHCR means the High Commissioner for Refugees, meaning the UN agency which treats all the non-Palestinian refugees, meaning the tens of millions all over the world, in the Ukraine, in Bangladesh, in the Congo, in the Balkans, in whatever you want. Okay, there's one agency, and then there's the Palestinian agency. By the way, we can also talk about why we need this second agency and what happened back in 1950 when there was an attempt to, you know, put them together. The Arab states understood very clearly that that would be the end of the right of return, and they rejected it. They objected to that. And in the 50s, they had a very strong voice and, you know, influenced the Cold War politics and were able to maintain UNRWA. But this is completely for political reasons. The only reason why UNRWA exists is for political reasons. Okay, this is why I'm saying that it's not a real problem. So just to finish the point, UNHCR, which means treating with all the other refugees on Earth, okay, which, as we know, unfortunately, there are a lot of troubles around the world, okay? So they're not better off. They're not these fancy refugees. No, they're real people with real, you know, problems. So there you have to come and register. It's not automatic. You have to bring all kinds of documents, and you have to be certified and registered. And from the practice, we know that the level of acceptance or approval of refugee status in the case of descendants in the UNHCR is very far from what's happening in the case of UNRWA. It's called derivative refugee status. And it's not going on to your, you know, again, to the next generation. In the case of UNRWA, it is simply automatic forever. This is the definition, very different from what's happening. In all the rest of the world, it's simply case by case. You have to come and you have to verify, meaning that out of those 200,000 Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Syria, there are 7,000 real refugees that if you apply international standards, would most probably be recognized as refugees. All the rest should be vetted case by case to see where they are, what's the living standards, are they really eligible for this status? That's a process. That's a process. And in the real world, many of these people do not get a refugee status. Only in the case of the Palestinians, it's automatic. So this is what I'm saying, that, again, if there's a will, there's a way. If you really want to solve the problem of finding, you know, resettlement of 10,000 refugees, 20,000 refugees, that's manageable. Canada can do it. Australia can do it if they want. I don't know, perhaps Indonesia can do it, but not 9 million people. Okay? This is what I'm saying. I'm saying that the refugee problem is a symbol. Okay? Like the entire concept of return, which I think is also crucial to understand. Because return, when they say we have the right of return, wherever you see the key, I don't know how many of you saw the speech of the PA president Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, last week in the General Assembly. So on his suit, he had this small symbol of a key, you know? The Israeli prime minister usually has the Israeli flag. Donald Trump had the American flag, but Mahmoud Abbas had a key, right? This is the head of the PA, and he says, what is the key? The key is the key to our lost houses, lost homes inside Israel, meaning in Jaffa, in Tel Aviv, in Haifa. This is the pre-1967 borders, right? So this is supposedly the legitimate or acknowledged internationally state of Israel. No, the president of the PA tells us very clearly, I want the right of return. I want to return to these houses. Okay, so just a little bit of explanation about return. Because return is very concrete. If you see all the, protests, and by the way, I've seen them now also in Europe. You see people who have never been in this area of the world holding keys. Supposedly they're returning to some kind of houses which, you know, probably don't exist. But they are talking actually about return. And I'll give you another example. On the morning of October 7th, when we have seen the terrible atrocities of people from Gaza entering into Israel, a head of one of the hospitals put on his, I think it was a Twitter account, he put a picture of ordinary Palestinians from Gaza. You saw them, elderly people and young children, going through this, you know, path into Israel. What they did in October 7th, they were holding their keys, and it was written, and that's a hospital manager, right? Not officially a Hamas terrorist. And he said, we're coming back. Okay? So October 7th, when they infiltrated the state of Israel and people call it a terror attack, that's return. That's return in the eyes of the Palestinians to the lands that they were kicked out of, in their view, in 1948. I'll give you another example. About 10 years ago, in 2018, I don't know if you remember, there was a march of return. There was a day after day or Friday after Friday, you know, hundreds of people, thousands of people, and they were marching towards the border. Now, it was called the March of Return. It wasn't called the March to Create an Independent State, the March to Improve the Economy. I don't know. It was called the March of Return. I mean, how, you know, what more do you need? And I remember watching the New York Times on their homepage. They had this, you know, they have these short videos. And a reporter of the New York Times was inside the Gaza Strip, and he was asking people there, why did you come here? What are you trying to say? And then there was a woman, a Palestinian woman, and she was saying very clearly, she said, you see there? And she was pointing towards the state of Israel, and she said, these are our lands, and we are here to take them back. We want to take them back. And then the reporter of the New York Times, you know, moved like this to the camera and said, well, as you can see, they're fighting to lift the blockade. And, you know, she was very explicit. She said what exactly they want. They want to return to the land. And he, and unfortunately, I think some of our establishment was under the same impression, that probably they just want a few more miles to fish, right, in the Mediterranean. Or they're fighting for a few more thousands of permits, okay? But they explain very clearly they are into this return. But one more thing, return in the Palestinian language, if you read and you know very well what they mean, they actually mean return in time. That's not only return in space. So for example, moving 10 kilometers to the east from Gaza to Shderot or to Netivot. Okay, yes, that's also that. But it's also return to a mythical time before the creation of the state of Israel. So the clock somehow should be turned back to those mythical paradise. They talk about a paradise. If you listen and you read stories and literature by Palestinians, there was a time when Palestine was simply a paradise and everybody had their olive trees and their groves and they had the little houses. And then came the Zionists and then came the Jews, the invasion of the Jews after the Balfour Declaration. They stole their lands and they destroyed everything they had. And this is the Nakba, right? This is the Nakba. And this is the times that we should go back to.
There's this tweet that has gone viral this week. There's a video of the Tel Aviv boardwalk full of people doing what they do in the Tel Aviv boardwalk, playing volleyball, roller skating, whatever. And some guy tweets, "This is Jaffa. My grandmother used to live here. She had a house and a bakery until the Zionists kicked them out." And like, no, actually, the Tel Aviv boardwalk was just sand dunes until a few Israelis said, "Let's build something next to the city of Jaffa." Like, it would be one thing if it was Tel Aviv University, which was actually a Palestinian village in 1948, but it just shows how clueless they are.
No, but wait a second. It shows how unrelated their descriptions are vis-a-vis the
reality.
Yeah. Okay, that's important, but it's also important to understand what's in their minds. They really think that they were this, you know, Adam and Eve walking in this complete paradise of this small bakery. By the way, according to the number of olive trees that supposedly, you know, were flourishing in Israel, like this whole country was, I don't know, like this huge oasis. It wasn't, okay? But never mind. This is, and when you teach generation after generation and, you know, in schools and indoctrinate everybody that this is your right and you have a refugee card by the international community, it's not even something that dad gave you. Okay, dad gives you this small picture of grandma. Okay, that's nice. But here you have UNRWA, you have schools, you go to schools, and this is by the international community. And who's paying for that, by the way? The Americans, the Europeans. So it's not even Qatar or Iran that you can say, okay, these are some kind of bad people that are ruining the chance for peace. No, Americans and Europeans who are, you know, for decades been promoting or saying that they want two-state solution and they want a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has been funding billions of dollars to sustain this, you know, obsession, which means that we should all be killed.
Some of these countries are countries that now have or now recognize the Palestinian Authority as the state of Palestine. So from their perspective, you have fourth generation Palestinians living in Palestine, citizens of Palestine, who are refugees
and from who are refugees
from Palestine in Palestine and who are therefore deserving of millions of dollars in services rather than going to schools of the state of Palestine. They go to special schools for refugees in Palestine.
Exactly. So for a Westerner, okay, for us, you know, it sounds very weird, okay? But why does it not sound for a Palestinian weird? Because when they say that they're refugees from Palestine, they mean Israel. For them, it's not weird. They know what they mean. Okay, Shechem or you know, Nablus or Jenin, that's temporary. That's temporary. They know when they say we live in part of Palestine and we want to go back to another part of Palestine because the whole territory is Palestine as is ours.
There's another logical fallacy where if people say Gaza, we're 70% refugees from our homeland. So the argument is, okay, well, you know, people who want to emigrate should be allowed to emigrate. How can they emigrate out of their homeland? But your argument is that you are refugees from your homeland in Gaza.
I think that there's a discourse which is one which is more Western in English, which somehow I think assumes, I still hope so. I don't know, we're now in a position where even that is questionable, that at least part of the state of Israel is legitimate. Okay, now we see that from the river to the sea means that no part of Israel is legitimate. But, you know, for many years, in many decades, Israel was member in the United Nations. So the international community was working under the premise that it's the territories which are, you know, to be discussed. And then if you recognize the state of Israel, then, okay, you negotiate over the Gaza Strip, Judea and Samaria. Okay, that's in English. That's in most European countries, but not for the Palestinians. The Palestinians were never on board with that issue. Okay, they were never on board with that image. For them, Palestine, the entire territory, meaning Haifa, West Jerusalem, Beersheba, everything is theirs. There is no room for a Jewish state, a Jewish sovereign state in the sense of, you know, what Zionism wanted and accomplished in 1948. In their view, there is no room for that. And I want to say something more, and this is why I'm very much afraid. You know, in the last 2 years, since 7th of October 7th, we have seen and, you know, and heard so many, even now, if you follow people who leave Gaza, flee Gaza, you can hear them, they curse and they are angry. And they say, oh my God, I lost my sister and my son and we didn't go to schools, etc. Day and night, you can hear that. But I still, after 2 years, have not heard anyone say, let's stop the war against the Jews. I haven't heard saying like, you know, we've tried for 100 years. Okay, we're a brave people. We are the Arab noble, whatever you want to say. But, you know, we've paid a heavy price and perhaps it's time that we can live next to the Jews. Even when they are angry at Hamas, it's not because Hamas has led them to the wrong way of not recognizing the Jewish state. It's just being reckless or, you know, not coordinating well enough with Hezbollah and Iran. So the issue is never about really thinking, you know, about priorities of this nation, of this group of people, but about how better to try and do it the next time. This is why I think that, okay, we've not even spoken about the, you know, the military side of what's going on, which in my view is not satisfactory at all. But even, you know, I mean, the political issue, the ideological issue, if we finish now and we don't do anything, then 100% of this population is devoted to this cause. And it's only a matter of time until we'll have more problems. You see it in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria. You see it. Rock, all of a sudden, people are you know, bewildered. Oh, they have rockets in Judea. Well, of course they have rockets. You know, look at what they're teaching their children. They're teaching their children for the last 100 years that the Jews are foreign. The Jews are illegitimate in this land. So yes, of course, some people choose to get up and, you know, go to work, etc. But those who have the chance to put up some, you know, I don't know, even if it's not a sophisticated weapon, they'll do it. They'll do it. So this is why I'm saying that we have to put an end, or at least, you know what, start the process.
So I want to bring it back to Trump's plan. And you had suggested conditioning things in the plan on anything real, on something, but you specified the refugee thing. But can you explain what exactly you think that Netanyahu should be asking for in this plan?
Okay, so let's say that there will be some kind of an authority, right? Whether it's Tony Blair, whether it's, I don't know whom. Again, it doesn't matter if it's international or Arab. It doesn't matter. If Palestinians want to do it, I'm fine with that. I don't care who does it. I care about the content. So that authority in their constitution or in their bylaws or whatever there will be, it should be clear. All the residents of Gaza, or at least under their authority, okay, if Hamas does not surrender, but under that new authority, no one in Gaza is a refugee, okay? We stop giving refugee cards. That's it. If you were born tomorrow, you are going to be born in Gaza, you are a resident of Gaza. You're not a refugee from Jaffa. We've ended it. That's it. We've paid this price for 77 years. No more refugee cards. If no refugees, there's no need for any refugee agency. So there's no need in refugee agency in, I mean, UNRWA should not be part of anything. Because in the Palestinian mind, they understand very well. If you leave their UNRWA, Jaffa is theirs, okay? And then making sure that it is understood no one has a right to return to Israel. Now, this is the authority. You know, some people, you can go even further with that and actually say that each neighborhood, there will be some kind of a reconstruction process, right? The rubble is the amounts of rubble are huge. You have to prioritize somehow. Okay, so you say, do you want to have a new school for your community? Do you want to have a new clinic for your community? Okay. You will get a community, you will get a clinic, you will get a hospital if you sign and if you agree that you understand that you're not a refugee, you don't have the right of return. Of course, you should supplement that with new curriculum in the education system and all of this stuff. But reconstruction, must be conditioned on some kind of a political change. Otherwise, it's back to all the rounds of... This is what we did in 2012, in 2018. The reconstruction of Gaza. Billions were poured in, no political change, and another round of fighting. So we have to come to terms with the real problem and start changing it. And by the way, if they're not willing, if this authority is not willing to sign on this, on if the Palestinians are not willing to sign, then leave it as it is. I'm sorry, there is no right to reconstruct Gaza if they are telling you, actually, we are going to do, because what does it mean? To say we're still refugees, we have a right of return, etc., 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 means we are going to do it in 2 years again. So I think no reconstruction. My idea is no reconstruction. If no political change, no reconstruction. You can sit on these rubbles for decades. That's my view. I don't think that the Germans after World War II and the Japanese after World War II could say to the Americans, well, you know, we will leave some kind of a Nazi, you know, government, and we will at least a few concentration camps, you know. No, that's it. You did October 7th. That's a turning point in the history of the conflict.
Dr. Adi Schwartz, thank you for joining us and for shedding light onto the reality. It's not always an easy reality. A lot of times people prefer wishful thinking, illusions, diplomatic political correctness. And I think you've given a perspective of what's actually happening on the ground. We're actually the core of the conflict. Obviously, there's a lot more we could talk about de-radicalization, about demilitarization, about the future of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to like, subscribe, and follow the Miskav Institute at www.miskavins.org and across all social media platforms. Send us your questions and comments to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. That's MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.